sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Professor Aaron Wolf, an expert on international water use, exploring water, cooperation, and peace in the Middle East. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Borel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. It's not often that we talk about NBA basketball here on Two Jewish, seeing that although I personally am a gigantic sports fan, this show is actually about Judaism and not about ball games. But in view of the Jewish connections to the recent media firestorm surrounding Los Angeles Clippers owner Donald Sterling, his racist comments, and NBA Commissioner Adam Silver banning him for life and urging other owners to force him to sell the team, we really have to talk about this today. It also provides an opportunity to discuss Judaism, bigotry, and racism, a complex reality that includes both perceptions and attitudes that we do not always acknowledge. First, the basic story, which is yucky. Donald Sterling has owned the LA Clippers for 33 years. Following the death last year of Jerry Buss, the longtime LA Lakers owner who is also beloved, that makes Sterling the longest tenured owner in the NBA. Sterling was born Donald Tokowitz in 1934 in Chicago, grew up in the old Jewish section of Los Angeles, Boyle Heights, in the late 40s and early 50s. He started out as an attorney, doing personal injury cases and divorces, moved into real estate ownership by buying apartment buildings in the booming 1960s in Southern California, and eventually became wildly rich in real estate. Sterling was actually a partner with Jerry Buss in some ventures. Buss selling out to Sterling gave him the last of the cash he needed to buy the Lakers and Kings from Jack Kent Cook. Anyway, after Buss bought the Lakers and began to have great success with them, he won the title his first year, he encouraged Sterling to buy the then San Diego Clippers, which Sterling did for $12.5 million in 1981. Sterling, personally, is now worth something like $2 billion, and the Clippers are worth about $500 million, possibly much more. Well, that's it on the good stuff. Generally speaking, Donald T. Sterling has long been considered the very worst owner in all of professional sports. While the Lakers were a wildly successful model franchise for decades and won many championships, the Clippers were perennial losers who made all the wrong moves, played in a lousy arena, and treated their players and employees miserably. They drafted the wrong guys, their best players got terribly injured, they fired the wrong people and hired the wrong people, and so on. There were various lawsuits against Donald Sterling over the years, including some for racial discrimination, and some fines were levied by the government and by the league. Mostly, the Clippers were a bad joke, and Sterling was considered to be idiotically cheap for a major professional sports owner, and more than a little mean. He refused to cover an assistant coach's cancer surgery. He has been fined by the federal government, at the time the largest fine of its kind, for discriminating against African-American tenants, and Sterling has a long and litigious history of being a jerk. On the plus side, it must be noted that Sterling did hire and keep employed Elgin Baylor, one of the first black general managers in professional sports, for many, many years, in spite of Baylor's general lack of success. That ended badly, too. Donald Sterling has a highly respected black head coach right now, Doc Rivers, and of course, most of the Clippers players are African American, as are 81% of the guys in the NBA. In the last 2 years, for one of the very few times in Sterling's long ownership, the Clippers have actually become a very good team. They have finally surpassed the Lakers in talent and accomplishment, if not yet in popularity. Now for the ugly incident last week. In a conversation with his then-girlfriend, a woman who has taken the name of V. Stiviano, but who was born Maria Vanessa Perez, and is partly Mexican-American and partly African-American, Donald T. Sterling made a variety of racist comments. This conversation was held in private, but the 31-year-old girlfriend of the 80-year-old man recorded the conversation without Sterling's knowledge, and somehow the recording made its way to the online gossip websites TMZ and Deadspin. Sterling is still married to his wife of 56 years, Shelley, although he has had a series of girlfriends, some of whom his wife has sued in court. This particular girlfriend has received lots of valuable gifts from Sterling, including $500,000 in automobiles and an expensive townhouse. What incurred his ire this time was that she posted photos of herself, she is very pretty, of course, with LA sports icons Magic Johnson and Matt Kemp, who are both, at least partly, African-American. So what happened, in essence, was that a very rich guy who owns an NBA team and who has a long history of not being nice had a fight with his mistress because he believed she was flaunting her other affairs with African-Americans on Instagram and apparently bringing some of those guys to Clippers games. Sterling then made a variety of racist comments to Stiviano, demonstrating that he believes African Americans are inferior and essentially work on his plantation, and she decided her sugar daddy was just a little bit too awful to stay with any longer. She is undoubtedly right. She decided to bring him down with his own voice as the evidence. Now, for the Jewish angle. The new commissioner of the NBA, Adam Silver, is a Jewish attorney. He recently succeeded the very successful long-term commissioner of the NBA, David Stern, also a Jewish attorney. In the midst of the firestorm of terrible publicity, Silver decided last week to ban Donald Sterling, originally a Jewish attorney, from the NBA for life, fined him the maximum of $2.5 million, and urged all the other NBA owners to force him to sell his team as soon as possible. Sterling basically seems like a garden variety racist. Not somebody who's going to send money to the Klan, but a guy who doesn't want African-American tenants because he believes they smell bad and bring in roaches. That Donald Sterling is Jewish does not improve matters at all, and in the conversation his mistress recorded, he even manages to insult Israel's handling of what he calls black Jews, somehow tarring Israel, which has accepted more immigrants of color per capita than any nation on earth in history, with the same racist brush he uses for everything. And when his floozy compares racism to the Holocaust and expects Sterling to be more sensitive on the subject because he is Jewish, the guy is outraged and calls her insane. I can only hope that he is not typical of NBA owners or, I guess, other professional sports rich guys in private. In the days before digital recording devices and social media, this whole mess would have been hidden away or sued out of existence, the kind of private sentiment that stupid and ignorant people continue to harbor. Nowadays, when everybody can hear everything awful anybody says as soon as they say it, there wasn't any possibility that the angry ravings of an offended old rich guy in sports weren't going to be everywhere. This whole distasteful situation seems somehow unsurprising from a guy like Donald Sterling, who's been involved in so much yuck over the years. As we would say in LA, leave it to the Clippers to screw up their most successful season ever. That a Jewish commissioner of the NBA suspended Sterling for life pretty much removes the Jewish angle from criticism, but it does still stun me that somebody Jewish, coming from a tradition and a people who have been subjected to such pervasive anti-Semitic racism over the centuries, could hold and share these views. And now Sterling can continue to have these views, but he will likely have to do it without his beloved dysfunctional basketball team. Good riddance. Unfortunately, I do personally know Jews who harbor racist views. American Jews who have attitudes kind of like this towards African Americans or Latinos, and Israelis who have such attitudes towards Arabs as well. But in my experience, this is a very tiny minority of Jews in either country. And in general, we Jews have a long and very well-documented history of championing the rights of African Americans and understanding and even sharing their story. To be honest, without Jews, the NBA would never have existed. Most of the early pioneers were Jewish owners, coaches, entrepreneurs, and back in the day, even great players. Today, Jews are likely to be commissioners or owners. By one count, 10 of the 30 NBA owners are Jewish, including Robert Sarver of the Phoenix Suns here in Arizona, who grew up at my own Temple Emmanuel, in the interests of full disclosure. There are only a handful of Jewish players in the NBA, some from Israel. But one less Jewish owner, if he's a racist, is okay by me. Of course, there are rumors that Jewish record and media tycoon David Geffen would now like to buy the Clippers. Anyway, in happier news, and to play us in this morning, Israel's 66th birthday is this week. Here's a favorite Israeli tune from star Rami Kleinstein and his song Artzenu Haktonet, Od Lo Tamu.
Artzenu Haktonet, Artzenu Hayafa, Moledet Bikutonet, Moledet Yechefa. קבליני אל שיריי, קלה יפהפייה, פתחי לי שעריי, עבור במודיה, בצל עצי החורש, הרחק מאור חמה, יחדיו נקה פה שורש, אל לב האדמה. אל מעיינות הזוהר, אל פירות התום, מולדת ללא תואר, בצועניתו. עוד לא תמו כל פלאי, עוד הזמר לא שר, עוד ליבי מכה עם ליל ולוחש לו בלה. את ליאת החר, את ליאת אמובה, את ליאת המעט, המעט שנותר.
That was Rami Kleinstein, a past guest of Two Jewish, singing Od Lo Tamu for Israel's 66th birthday. Our small land, our beautiful land. Your wonders continue still. For Yom HaAtzmaut, Israeli Independence Day, this coming Wednesday. Our guest this morning, Professor Aaron Wolf, is an expert on water, on international use and cooperation over water, and on water in the Middle East. It's a fascinating area, and we'll explore his Jewish inspirations and the implications of water issues when we return on To Jewish.
I was 15 when I started my first business, and I never looked back. When it came time for college, I looked for a university that would foster my entrepreneurial spirit and that also had a sense of community. ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business ranks among the best in the nation, and the several Jewish organizations on campus make it easy for ASU to become a home away from home. At ASU, I'm upholding the traditions of my family while pursuing my dreams, and as CEO of Simple, I'm well on my way. I'm Arthur Steingart, and I'm a Sun Devil. ASU. Dream it. Do it. Visit asu.edu.
We welcome to Two Jewish this morning our guest, Professor Aaron Wolf, Professor of Geography at the College of Earth, Ocean, Atmospheric Sciences at Oregon State. But he is much more than that, very active in cooperative work, in publishing, and in trans-border use of water and mediation in those areas. Worked as a consultant for the U.S. Department of State, the U.S. Agency for International Development, the World Bank, and a variety of governments in doing this crucial work. Welcome back to Two Jewish.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be back here in Tucson.
So, use of water is really a critical issue around the world, and increasingly so as populations grow and some of our water sources dry up or are damaged. Let's talk a little bit about where these issues are most important right now and what your work has been in those areas.
Sure. So the big issue around water resources is simply people don't have enough of it for simple survival or ecosystem survival. So 2.5 to 5 million people die every single year simply for lack of access to sanitation or a safe water supply. Ecosystem degradation, a massive scale. So just to put this in terms of orders of magnitude of crisis, this is as big as HIV/AIDS and as big as malaria, and it's bigger than anything else. So that's a bigger destruction than all the wars in any given year put together. It's bigger than tsunamis and droughts and floods. All these. So the crisis is huge. parallel to that and related to that are the political ramifications. So water ignores political boundaries, and that's usually where I get involved, is rivers and aquifers that are shared by two or more countries need somehow some kind of agreement in order to manage the resources efficiently.
So the area that's certainly of interest to two Jewish listeners and to me personally is the Middle East, where water is in short supply, and I know this will shock everybody, people don't always get along. Israel uses a very high percentage of its water. Talk a little bit about the transporter issues there.
Sure. So everywhere there's a border with Israel, there's also a water issue. So when the boundaries were actually being crafted from...
Crafted is a very kind word to use for the boundaries were created in that part of the world.
Fair enough. The sources, particularly the sources...
When the borders were arrived at by accident...
Water was very much on everybody's minds, on both the Zionists and the Arabs were paying attention to where particularly the sources of the Jordan were as the northern boundary was being negotiated, first between Great Britain and France, and then later between Arabs and Israelis. And then over the years, it's been absolutely critical. It's been a component when the peace talks officially started in the 90s, there were five multilateral tracks. One of them was water resources. Groundwater that's shared between Israel and Palestine is a major component in negotiations. Where the wall was designed, water was on the minds, a factor. So it's been subtext to a number of the issues around both cooperation and conflict between Arabs and Israelis.
We will talk much more with Professor Aaron Wolf when we come back a little bit later this morning on Too Jewish.
Among my most pleasant, at least time-consuming duties, I have the honor of serving as president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, which celebrates the memories of Rabbi Samuel S. and A. Irma Kohan, my own grandparents. Once a year, the foundation gives a substantial cash award to an individual for outstanding service to Klal Yisrael, the totality of the Jewish people. This service can involve any one of four different fields: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. If you know of anyone who might qualify for the 2013 Kohan Award, just visit our website, www.kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N, and you'll find the nomination form to submit. And while you're there, you can also learn just who my own grandparents were and who participates in honoring their memory today. That's kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N-A-W-A-R-D. It's a good visit.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke, new sponsors here on Too Jewish. We started talking last week about Freedom Smoke, the smokeless product, no tobacco, to get people off of cigarettes. What are the health advantages to using your product as opposed to smoking?
Thank you, Rabbi Kohan. We have a lot of physicians here in town, from neurologists to ophthalmologists, cardiologists, pulmonologists, sending patients to us because of damaging effects from emphysema, everything of the like that comes from smoking cancerous cigarettes.
And Freedom Smoke International provides all kinds of flavors, pleasurable experience, but not the same health risk.
That's right. You have the same experience as smoking. You have the hand-to-mouth, the mantra of the In-N-Out, as well as vapors compared to cigarette smoke. So there's no secondhand smoke either.
How can people find your product?
They can find us through freedomsmokeusa.com. Our toll-free number, which is here in Tucson, is 800-705-7013.
And then go into a store.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We have three stores. We're opening a fourth in the next couple of months here in town.
We will talk more next week. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch or Kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can stream all past and present shows through the website or download us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. The Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is coming up fast, June 11th to June 23rd, 2014. Last call if you want to go with me on this fabulous journey to Israel, seeing it all from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Tzfat to the Sea of Galilee to Jerusalem. Please email twojewishradio18@gmail.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information and an itinerary. We welcome Rav Mivi Nahan, Israel Oshrat Barel, head of the Wine Tribe Israel Center. Boker Tov Oshrat, Chag Sameach,
Chag Atzmaut Sameach.
Chag
Atzmaut Sameach.
Happy Israeli Independence Day. There's a big event coming up this Wednesday as part of the celebration of Israel's 66th birthday. Big,
yeah.
66 seems like a good number anyway.
Yeah.
Tell us what's going on.
So this Wednesday we will host at the JCC. It will be inside a lot of vendors that will present, you know, all the congregation and artists. It will be nice. And outside it will be lots of kids activities that will imitate Israel. They will have their own passport with their photo, and they will go from a place, like they will build a snowman in Hermon, and then they will dig the Negev. It will be very nice for kids to learn about Israel and to experience it. And also we'll have many community choirs, Jewish choirs, that will give us a beautiful background music. And just before the Israeli performer Elior Balawi, we will have, like, we are imitating this year one of the, if not the most important ceremonies in Israel, which is the transition ceremony between Yom HaZikaron to, from the Memorial Day and to Yom HaTzmaut, the Independence Day. There is a ceremony with the president, the prime minister, and everyone, that every year there are choosing 12 people that made huge difference in the state of Israel, and they honoring them. So this year we will honor 12 women, because this is the theme in Israel, women, and we will honor 12 women, local women from Tucson, that made a huge difference by their, you
work
know,
with people work in Israel,
in
work
Israel,
with Israel,
yeah.
In Israel itself.
And after this this ceremony, we will have the Israeli performer Lior Balawi that will perform and also do sing along and will teach us some songs, and it will be beautiful.
Sounds like a fantastic
and
experience. And food.
Yeah.
So falafel?
Yes.
And other
and
types
others.
Of Israeli
yeah.
food. One of the things that I
By
think...
By the way, falafel, it's not Israeli. But this is for next time.
It's kind of Middle Eastern, but we yeah. can talk about the history of falafel
yeah,
and what
yeah,
it's
yeah.
all about.
We're not going to ruin the Israeli.
No, no, let's yeah. not ruin anybody's
yeah, yeah, yeah,
image
yeah.
of Israel by not letting them eat an Israeli falafel.
Yeah.
I understand Ariel Sharon, you see two at a time, which I find stunning, because once you've eaten one big falafel with all the stuff, it's impossible to eat any more food for like hours. But no, I understand. Everyone, it's this Wednesday at the Tucson JCC.
JCC
starts at
5 to 9.
Yeah. You can come for any
parents,
part of it and all of it.
For parents that want to stay like to the end, there is a babysitting for the kids.
Excellent. And you can enjoy the whole thing. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million-dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about immigration and migration the last several weeks. We talked about the huge Jewish wave of immigration to the United States from the 1880s to the 1920s, which included most of the ancestors of most Jews present in the United States today. A lot of them came from, as you said, the former Tsarist lands, often through various other countries. One place that a lot of Jews came from, which wasn't an independent country in those days, was Ukraine.
Right. So, in fact, those Jews who came from what eventually was the Soviet Union, but not in the 1880s or 1890s, were required by law, at least in theory, to live in the so-called Pale of Settlement, which is where Jews were allowed to live without special permits and without jumping through all kinds of hoops. And so that excluded big cities like Moscow and St. Petersburg. And also, interestingly, in terms of today's current events and problems in Ukraine, the east bank of the Dnieper, the eastern half of Ukraine, where the majority population is Russian and where so many of these problems are, was not included in the Pale of Settlement. And there were actually very few Jews there. The Jews who lived in what is now Ukraine were all in Western Ukraine. And parts of what is now Western Ukraine were, in fact, parts of Austro-Hungary or Romania or other countries at the time. So my father's parents came from a part of Hungary that is now Western Ukraine, and the majority of the population there still speaks Hungarian. There are other parts of Western Ukraine where the majority speaks Romanian or Polish or other languages because borders have been changed so many times there. But the important thing, I think, in terms of current events, and we talked about Crimea, so Odessa, which is sort of the capital of Crimea, or certainly near enough to matter, was the third biggest Jewish city in the world for a long time after Warsaw and New York. And the lingua franca among the various Greeks, Armenians, and others who lived there was Yiddish. I mean, almost everyone in town, including Russian officials, spoke Yiddish. So one of the groups of people that are hugely affected by the contemporary crisis in Crimea are Jews. But this crisis has now spilled over, as was feared, into eastern Ukraine. And in these Russian-majority areas, Russian autonomists have seized buildings, denied the authority of the Ukrainian government, declared their intention to secede. And I fear that this may have been caused by Russian media play given to the talks between Kerry and Lavrov, which talked about a possible federalization of Ukraine. And the Russian media or social media may have spun this into, okay, this means autonomy for eastern Ukraine. And this could quickly get way out of control.
Wouldn't surprise anybody, and that does seem to be Putin's kind of general goal, is to re-expand the Russian Empire. We will talk next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Goldberg climbs to the top of Mount Sinai so he can get close enough to talk to God. Looking up, he asks the Lord, "Oh, wondrous God, what does a million years mean to you?" And the Lord replies, "A million years is like a minute to me." So Goldberg asks, "Oh, all-powerful Lord, what does $1 million mean to you?" And God replies, $1 million is like a penny to me." "Well then," says Goldberg, "great, mighty Lord, can I have a penny?" And God replies, "In a minute." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Behar from the book of Leviticus, which establishes the rules for the sabbatical and jubilee years, the most important form of environmental legislation in the ancient world. Concern for the environment in Judaism has always been a key part of our tradition. The very first text on caring for the natural world goes back to Genesis, where we are commanded to be stewards of God's creation. But the most important Jewish legislation in the Torah on this subject is found in Leviticus. In a section we read this week in Behar, "You shall have a sabbatical. Every seventh year the land shall rest. We're instructed to do no active planting or cultivation, to allow fields to lie fallow, to give the earth a chance to rest. This is considered to be good, practical agricultural policy today. It allows time for nature to restore the nutrients that grains leach from the soil. It allows the fallen fruit in the orchards to nourish the loam. It's a fundamental part of crop rotation in all areas practicing modern farming." The remarkable fact about this Shemitah, this sabbatical mitzvah, is that it originated in the Torah, a document at least 2,500 years old, and which contains text that's quite probably 800 years older than that. That is, the scientific concern for the health of the environment goes back 3,000 years in Judaism, and the requirement to care for the natural world as responsible human beings is at least as long-standing. There are many more commandments in the Torah relating to stewardship of the natural world. Even in warfare, we're prohibited from destroying our enemy's fruit trees or seriously damaging the productive capacity of the land to feed its inhabitants. This is in sharp contrast to the ancient Roman Empire's policy, sowing salt in the fields of conquered enemies to destroy them and to create forced starvation. Ironically, this is also in contrast to the occasional policy of the Israeli military to bulldoze the olive trees of Arab terrorist families. The injunction is clear. We are supposed to respect the natural environment. It is a reflection of God's holiness projected into our world. It is also a not-so-subtle hint that we need to seek other kinds of sources of energy, renewable ones, solar power, geothermal, wind power, that do not damage the world God has given us. There are other contemporary consequences for this most ancient commandment. The sabbatical year off from teaching, so beloved on university campuses, comes directly from this week's portion of Behar. It's a time to recharge your batteries and renew your scholarship, just as the land replenishes itself through a year of Shemitah, divine rest. It's a great lesson in a world in which we often seem more intent on domination than cultivation, and a reminder that even renewable resources like people need tending. May we learn Behar's lesson well and so allow our land to renew itself. And then, perhaps, we might even learn to allow ourselves some rest and so come to replenish our spiritual resources, say, each week on Shabbat. Water is a critical natural resource in our world today, and just how renewable it is a crucial question. But water is also integrally important in international negotiations, particularly in the Middle East. Find out how water resources, rights, and negotiations are conducted, how Jewish values affect them, when we return with our guest, an expert on water and international water negotiations, and water in Israel especially, Professor Aaron Wolf. Hear from him when we come back on Too Jewish.
I was 15 when I started my first business, and I never looked back. When it came time for college, I looked for a university that would foster my entrepreneurial spirit and that also had a sense of community. ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business ranks among the best in the nation, and the several Jewish organizations on campus make it easy for ASU to become a home away from home. At ASU, I'm upholding the traditions of my family while pursuing my dreams, and as CEO of Simple, I'm well on my way. I'm Arthur Steingart, and I'm a Sun Devil. ASU, dream it, do it. Visit asu.edu.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The 50 members of the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations voted last week not to admit J Street, the organization that is pro-Israel and pro-peace, but has also been somehow accused of being anti-Israel. The vote was 17 in favor of admission, 22 against, and 3 abstentions. Since it requires a two-thirds or three-quarters vote, the number of yes votes was far lower than needed and far lower than expected. The significance of this particular vote to keep J Street out, happening at a polarized moment for American Jews as the latest peace talks with the Palestinians predictably fail, revolves around how to be inclusive in the American Jewish community's establishment and how inclusive it wishes to be itself. Being admitted to the President's Conference is a symbol of legitimacy, Brandeis professor Jonathan Sarna, a multiple past guest of Two Jewish, said, "Every community has boundaries. The question really is, what is acceptable? What are the communal bounds? I think that so many organizations have already turned out in favor of J Street. To some extent, they've already won." Well, many members of this Conference of Presidents had been closed-mouthed on how they planned to vote or how they voted, but confirmed yes votes we know about included the ADL, the Union for Reform Judaism, the United Synagogue of Conservative Judaism, and the Conservative Movement's Rabbinical Assembly, which has a separate vote. Other organizations, including the Jewish Labor Committee, the Jewish Council on Political Affairs, the JCPA, Workman's Circle, National Council of Jewish Women, Amenu, and Americans for Peace Now, are also assumed to have voted for J Street. ADL National Director Abe Foxman had said, "We will support the admission of J Street not because we agree with them, not because we support their views, but in order to ensure the integrity and credibility of American Jewish advocacy and of the Conference of Presidents." Well, maybe not so much. "Membership in the President's Conference is deemed to be a sense of legitimization," Sarna said. "The President's Conference is symbolic. That's why they were eager to join. That's why people will pay attention to this vote. I think it will help determine what the boundaries of acceptable discourse are. On the one hand, J Street has made it very clear they support Israel and oppose BDS. But on the other hand, they clearly disagree with a big part of the policies of the Jewish establishment. Frankly, it's very unfortunate that this Conference of Presidents chose not to include J Street, but does more to diminish the Conference of Presidents than it does to diminish J Street, which is a rising player." In other news, the online tablet magazine last week ran a piece by Yair Rosenberg that addressed a magnificently stupid New York Times story about the Holocaust-denying Palestinian president of Fatah and parts of the West Bank, Abu Mazen, also known as Mahmoud Abbas, president of the Palestinians. His article deserves paraphrasing here on Too Jewish. He said, "One of the ugly truths about Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas is that he has a PhD in Holocaust denial, literally so. His 1982 dissertation, written when he was a student at Patrice Lumumba University, now the People's Friendship University of Russia in Moscow, and published as The Other Side, The Secret Relationship Between Nazism and Zionism, famously argues that the Zionists collaborated with the Nazis in order to spur more Jewish immigration to what was then called Palestine. The Zionist movement, Mahmoud Abbas explains, led a broad campaign of incitement against the Jews living under Nazi rule in order to arouse the government's hatred of them, to fuel vengeance against them, and to expand the mass extermination. According to Abbas, the Zionists were the Third Reich's basic partner in crime. The now Palestinian president asserts that the figure of 6 million Jews murdered has been exaggerated for political gain. He suggests 1 million is a more reasonable estimate. Abbas has never repudiated the document. In fact, he regularly reaffirms its argument, saying just a year ago that he had 70 more books that I still haven't published, proving the Zionist-Nazi partnership. However, according to last week's New York Times, just in time for Yom HaShoah last week, it all changed. An article headlined "Mahmoud Abbas Shifts on Holocaust" has the supposed scoop, saying President Mahmoud Abbas of the Palestinian Authority issued a formal statement calling the Holocaust the most heinous crime to have occurred against humanity in the modern era, which it was, and expressing sympathy with the victims' families. The Times went on to add, "The statement is the first such offering of condolences by the Palestinian leader." Oh, nice. The Times goes on to say, "Abbas has been vilified as a Holocaust denier because in his doctoral dissertation, he challenged the number of Jewish victims and argued that Zionists had collaborated with Nazis to propel more people to what would become Israel." Given how supposedly revolutionary Abbas's new statement is, Times readers would be confused to discover that, contrary to that, Abbas has acknowledged the reality of the Holocaust for decades. He just thinks that we Jews helped perpetrate it. His doctoral dissertation didn't claim the Holocaust never took place, although it did take 6 million and drop it down to 1 million, even though the Nazis carefully murdered and documented the people they murdered. And Abbas never said it wasn't a terrible atrocity, but he has argued all along that Zionists joined forces with the Nazis to inflict that atrocity on European Jewry. In other words, Abbas sickeningly crafted a position that allowed him to acknowledge the Holocaust and somehow blame the Jews for it. Abbas has not repudiated this. On the contrary, he consistently reasserts it and defends it from criticism. Which means, If anyone wants to find out if the Palestinian leader has finally dumped his conspiracy theories about the Holocaust, they should ask him not whether it happened, but who he thinks was responsible, which, according to Abbas, was the evil Zionists, who collaborated with the Nazis to help slaughter their Jewish brothers and sisters. Abbas is now considered the voice of Palestinian moderation, but you know, he knows a lot about slaughtering Jews. It was his own personal money that financed the Munich Olympic murder of Israeli athletes in 1972, and he was intimately involved in Yasser Arafat's long campaign of murderous terrorism against Jews and lots of other people. Abbas is also famously corrupt, like pretty much everybody in the PLO hierarchy, following the usual process of siphoning off international aid funds for personal and family use. And Mahmoud Abbas is also likely the best the Palestinians have to offer right now. Just don't for a minute believe he has abandoned his Holocaust-denying beliefs. In other news from Israel, security forces led by the Shin Bet arrested members of a Hamas-affiliated terror cell in Qalqilya who were plotting a campaign of bombings and shootings against Israeli targets. The suspects were arrested in a series of raids between December and March. They were in the early phase of planning terror attacks on Israeli targets in the West Bank and also within the Green Line in Israel proper, according to everyone. The Shin Bet also reported that West Bank terror attacks more than doubled last year. The members of this particular terror cell had begun construction of homemade explosives. Among the suspects are a 21-year-old, Khaled Mahmoud Daoud, an Israeli Arab citizen, and six Palestinians, two of them brothers, plus 30-year-old Salah Daoud, a prominent Hamas member in Qalqilya. They built improvised explosive devices using agricultural fertilizers and carried out tests of bombs they prepared, including setting off an improvised explosive. They planned on purchasing firearms from Israel, the Shin Bet added. The suspects will be indicted in court and formally charged with a host of terror-related offenses. Palestinian Authority security forces arrested some of the suspects before Israel took them into custody, but they were released in spite of being in possession of remote-control bomb detonators. This investigation has shown once again the motivation that exists on the ground for carrying out terror attacks against Israelis. It also demonstrates the concealed risk in the recruitment of Israeli citizens by terror organizations in order to carry out these attacks, the Shin Bet said. And finally, in the growingly lawless nation Ukraine, Gennady Kernis, the Jewish mayor of the second largest city in Ukraine, Kharkiv, was shot in the back last week while jogging. He's now fighting for his life in a hospital in Israel. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World.
We're delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish, our outstanding guest this morning, Professor Aaron Wolf of Oregon State University, a water expert and an expert on transboundary uses of water, and highly active in mediating some of these disputes on behalf of the State Department, on behalf of individual governments, critical issue in terms of water. We started talking earlier in the show about the Middle East and some of the water issues and how important water usage and issues are between Israel and its neighbors, between Israel and the Palestinians. I've heard that Israel successfully utilizes like 91% of its water supply. In contrast, what percentage does America use of its water supply?
Oh, it depends on where you are in the States. Anywhere, it can be 10 to 50%. I mean, it's just efficiencies are so much higher in Israel than they are here.
And I was told by an Israeli, they have to be.
They have to be.
Tell us about how water is, and you've had some involvement. Tell us a little bit about the current water issues there and how they affect Israel, how they're affecting Israel's neighbors.
Sure. So basically, Israel, quote, ran out of water in 1968. That means demand hit supply, and that's basically our hydrologic limit. So everything that's happened since then, the growth in population, growth in economics, the level of stress on the resource, all of that has come at greater and greater efficiency, and that's why they can be where they are. So what they've done is a whole series of steps, starting with at some point used to be famous for Jaffa oranges and agriculture, and there was a drought in the early 90s, and they simply cut unilaterally 40% of their water from agriculture and started to think about...
I was living in Israel during the drought, and they had, you know, this line, which they still do, I think, on the Sea of Galilee, which is sort of a principal water supply, and it got lower and lower, and you could just sort of feel the tension in the country.
Absolutely. Well, there's saltwater springs under the Sea of Galilee, and if that freshwater level gets too low, their major...
They're salinating their principal water supply.
Precisely right. So they started with moving water out of agriculture. They're tremendous champions of things like drip irrigation and greater efficient use in greenhouses, and they went to high-end crops, and then they started to recycle all their water. So most of the water in Israel now gets recycled and then put on agriculture. You almost don't use fresh water at all or rainwater at all for agriculture anywhere in Israel. Now, of course,
if it falls on the crops, it's okay.
That's
though,
okay.
Right?
That's right. Unfortunately, it doesn't fall when you need it. So,
right. So
they have to move it around. And then finally, their biggest push has been with desalinization, and that's where a lot of the pressure has been lifted, because now they're at a point where they're desalinating something like 30 or 40% of their annual water supply.
So it's coming out of the Mediterranean, being desalinated and put into the water system.
Correct.
And of course, the other good news is they just found a lot of natural. They're just accessing a huge natural gas field. So the high energy costs of desalinating are partly paid for by having access to energy.
Correct.
In terms of the rest of the Middle East, obviously everybody's not able to do what Israel's doing, or the rest of the Middle East, at least the neighbors, Israel's neighbors. Are they in critical situations with water supplies too?
It depends on where. If you happen to be a country sitting on oil, then you're not. So most of the desalination in the world is actually in the Persian or Arabian Gulf. That's where most of the capacity is. If you don't have oil, then you're really out of luck. So in Jordan, for example, in Amman, there's you get water delivered maybe once a week, if that, and you have to store the rest of the time. And just the amount that people use per capita, and compound that within the political difficulties, you really have a lot of inefficiency and suffering going on in a lot of the neighborhood.
And you would think, you know, a civil war situation, the first thing they're thinking about is not protecting the water supply and the water carriers.
Absolutely not. The opposite. Often water is used as a weapon in conflict.
You have become more involved in mediating some of those water conflicts. Tell us a little bit about what motivates you. And you mentioned off mic that you've been motivated to use spiritual text, particularly Jewish text. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So I was trained in conflict resolution using a very kind of rational Western model that conflict is rational. And anybody who's been involved in conflict, or for that matter, anybody in a relationship,
married.
Knows that. Yes, exactly. There's just rationality is only a very small part of it. And so what I did notice over and over in these processes was there were transformative moments in the room where suddenly the whole room is getting something different, some profound understanding different. And so what I went after consciously was some understanding of what are the settings that are conducive to transformative moments, and what are the tools we might use. There's only a couple of places you can go for that kind of understanding. People are transformed when they have kids, or God forbid they get sick, but they're also transformed in spiritual settings. And so what I went after about 8 years ago and have been pursuing since are what are the constructs within spiritual traditions that help us understand the source of conflict and anger better, and what are the tools that are used within those settings that we might bring into our negotiation settings. A lot of those are absolutely from Jewish roots.
When you're in one of these situations and you try to find kind of a meta level at which people can connect, a spiritual level, do you have a favorite text that you use? Are there one or two that you tend to call on? I hate to put you on the spot, but, you know, if you're a mediator, you used to be on the spot.
It's not so much text, it's understanding. So the idea of the four Kabbalistic worlds that we understand are Moses' four levels of holiness going up Mount Sinai, which is then reconstructed in the design of the temple, which is then reconstructed in the design of our prayer service.
Right.
That turns out to be a universal construct. This idea of the prayer service, Sacharit, going from your physical, your emotional, your intellectual, your spiritual levels, and that's guided meditation, that those are the four foundations of Buddhism that he went, that the Buddha achieved enlightenment doing the same meditation, that you find it in Islam, you find it in Christianity, you find that construct, and it helps to model kind of the flow of negotiations. And people start really honing in and getting agitated when their physical needs are challenged. But you can move that through and use that construct, moving us through emotional water, through intellectual water, and at some point to spiritual water, where we get a chance really to think about what we share.
So I didn't know that the Shacharit service was going to be a model for resolving water disputes around the world. That's a great concept. Beautifully stated. So as an American and living in the West, I drive over several aqueducts when I drive to California to see family. They're wide open, unlined, and they're the Colorado River water is flowing through there. Just a wild guess. I bet a lot of that evaporates.
It does, but the cost of covering it is actually higher than the cost of the water that's lost. And that's really why we're so far behind places like Israel and Australia in what we're willing to do, because we're still using water once and it goes away. We're still putting water to uses that have very very low marginal values. And so thinking about how to use our water more efficiently is absolutely the first thing we could be doing here in the West.
I drive to Phoenix, I go to Phoenix, I see people watering their lawns in July, large grass lawns, and I don't think Tucson's so advanced in water usage, but my goodness. Does this require, besides government involvement, doesn't it require citizens to just look around and say, you know what, that's not a good use of water?
I think that makes a lot of sense. More often than not, people are driven more by incentives and disincentives than
economic
they are.
Correct.
So when the price of water starts to rise, people will use less of it. And that's what happens in Israel and Australia. I think in Tel Aviv right now, you must pay close to $1 a cubic meter, something like this. For us in Oregon, we pay 0.004 cents for the same cubic meter. So there's no incentive for us to even think about using water more efficiently. So I think those are the kinds of things that as we hit the boundaries more and more, and certainly California's feeling it, that's something that we're gonna start to do more and more of.
And California, the largest agricultural state in America, which Correct. Nobody really thinks about, and they've had a tremendous water deficit, although then they got a lot of snow at the end of the season, so now people are going to breathe again. When you seek to mediate a dispute, is it usually because there's a scarcity of water? Is it an economic issue? What comes into it?
Well, often when I get called in, it's something very immediate. Often a dam or some other infrastructure that's causing real concern. Or different countries may want to work together to figure out how to do something like treat their pollution that crosses boundaries. Those are the times that I usually get called in. And these big structures are often major concern for downstream countries. Right now, there are a couple of places in the world. Ethiopia is building a big dam called the Renaissance Dam. Egypt is concerned. Tajikistan wants to build the biggest dam in the world. Downstream, Uzbekistan is concerned. Laos is building dams, and other countries on the Mekong are concerned. So that's the kind of thing that's very, very immediate, and people need to have focused discussions very quickly.
I remember being in Egypt and going to visit the Aswan High Dam, which Russia built for Egypt when Egypt was a client during the Cold War. And everybody thought it was going to be a great thing, and the Nile wouldn't flood anymore, and it did some great things and it did some terrible things. The presence of Girardia, skyrocketed upward. A lot of Egyptians suddenly became clients of the state because they no longer had enough water to grow crops. Are there always unexpected results from large projects like that?
Yeah, I think there are. The term technofix actually was coined by the director of Oak Ridge National Labs to talk about the unintended. When he's talking about fix, he's talking about like a drug. You get addicted to these big technology that's trying to solve both technical and social problems. And inevitably, whatever it is, he was talking actually about nuclear desalination in the 1960s, nuclear power in general. And remember, at the time, it was going to be too cheap to meter and was going to solve all the world's problems. And then we had all the unintended consequences, which in turn you need big technology for, which has unintended consequences, and so on and so on. That's the fix. We end up addicted to big technology when we think it can solve our problems.
I want to thank Aaron Wolf, who certainly works to try to solve our problems in water. And where can people go to find out more about, not only about your work, but about water and dealing with water in our society?
Oh, sure. So if you Google water, there's a ton of hits.
You get a lot of hits for water.
But you can look at our website at Oregon State University, Transboundary Waters. We have a lot of references there, not only to the work that we do, that my group does at OSU, but a ton of other references as well.
Thank you. When we come back on Two Jewish, we're about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Annie Jacobson, author of the new book Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America. Our playout this morning comes for Yom HaAtzmaut, Israel's 66th Independence Day, this coming Tuesday night and Wednesday. It's the popular Israeli song Yachad, Together. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, a good Israeli Independence Day, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Yachad, lev elev, niftach v'nir'e. Ta'or sheba shamayim, yachad, lev elev, niftach betikva. La'ahava,
ech she'alev niftach.